Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is May 7th, and I felt like this one just needed a little bit of an introduction from me before we get rolling here, because this show covers a lot of ground. It goes, and I will say that it has one consistent theme running through it, and what we really deal with in this show is the importance of checking our premises, the importance of defining terms appropriately in our efforts to persuade other people, making sure they're defining their terms correctly, and background knowledge. So logic is just one aspect of critical thinking, and no matter how logically tight some of your arguments might be, or as we'll see today, somebody else's arguments might be, I'm going to use Sam Harris as an example, if the premises are wrong, that doesn't matter. We also, in today's show, when James Corbett comes into it eventually, I also have to tell you the introduction is kind of long. It's about 40 minutes, and it deals with the free will versus determinism debate. James does come into the show after that. We're also going to explore the question, are human beings naturally logical? So this is a big one, goes a lot of places. If you like a show that is like a finely planned meal where everything on the plate just goes perfectly with everything else, this is not that. This is more like the buffet, you know, where you might get a little pudding in your fried rice, but it's okay because everything is delicious. True story, that happened to me at a buffet one time. All right, here we go.
The logic is not enough. Logical argumentation will not in and of itself arrive at certainty. How can I say this? Well, I can demonstrate it to you with a few basic examples that show that logic and the truth of one's conclusions are not inextricably interrelated. How can I say this? Well, for example, you can have a completely logically valid argument that is completely, totally true, that adheres to all the laws of logic, that arrives at a false conclusion. So, for example, we have, let's take the example, all dogs are brown, Snoopy is a dog, therefore Snoopy is brown. People might recognize this is the classical Greek syllogism, the one of the most revered, simplest forms of logical reasoning. If A, then B, A, therefore B. In this case, Snoopy, if all dogs are brown, Snoopy is a dog, therefore Snoopy is brown. It's not true. Snoopy is not brown. Snoopy is black and white. What has gone wrong? Oh, it turns out one of the premises, all dogs are brown, that's not true. Some dogs are black. Some dogs are white. Some dogs are black and white. Some dogs are purple if we spray paint them to be such. So it does not actually hold that all dogs are brown. Therefore, we can arrive at that false conclusion. Snoopy is brown. Even though the logical argument, the structure of the argument itself is unimpeachable, there is no fallacy involved in that argument. It's just that the premise was actually wrong. We can also have other permutations of this. We can have an argument that is valid, that reaches a true conclusion, but has a false premise. So, for example, we can say that all dogs are black and white, and Snoopy is a dog, therefore Snoopy is black and white. Well, again, it's the syllogism, if A then B, A therefore B, that's all sound, it's a logically valid argument. The conclusion is true, Snoopy is black and white. But the premise itself was, again, wrong. Not all dogs are black and white. So we have a completely valid argument, we have a true conclusion, but still, one of the premises was completely false. We can also have a completely different situation. We can have a completely fallacious argument that ends up with a true conclusion. So you could say that, for example, all dogs have four legs, and Snoopy has four legs, therefore Snoopy is a dog. Well, let's, for the moment, leave out the idea of those poor three-legged amputee dogs. Let's not even bring that in. Let's just say that it's true, the premise is true, that all dogs have four legs. But in this case, this is a logically fallacious argument. All dogs have four legs, Snoopy has four legs, therefore Snoopy is a dog. This is that type of fallacy called affirming the consequent. That means it looks like the syllogism, but it's slightly different. It's not if A then B, A therefore B. It's if A then B, B therefore A, which is not logically valid. It is a flawed argument. But in this case, we arrive at a true conclusion. Snoopy is a dog. And, well, does that mean that this was logically valid after all? No, it's a logically fallacious argument that employs a fallacy, but we still arrive at a true conclusion. This is something that we can use to understand something called the argument from fallacy, or if you want, the fallacy, whereby just because there is a flaw in an argument, just because an argument is fallacious, does not mean that its conclusion is wrong. In fact, its conclusion can be completely true. It could be true, it could be false, we don't know. But all it's saying is that just because there's a fallacy in an argument doesn't mean that it's false. So to argue from fallacy is to say, well, look, that guy used a fallacy in his argument, therefore it's wrong. Well, the argument may be invalid, but that doesn't mean the conclusion is wrong. So we have to understand that logically valid statements and logical reasoning are not inextricably interlinked with true conclusions. That something can be logically valid and arrive at a true conclusion. It can be logically valid and arrive at a false conclusion. It can be fallacious and arrive at a true conclusion. It can be fallacious and arrive at a false conclusion. The important thing is the way that the premises work together with the arguments. And there's a lot to be said about this. For one, I mean, how often does it come up in our daily life that we can form a classical syllogism? All A are B, A therefore B. Things don't tend to fall into those nice categories that we can easily summarize and encapsulate in a logical statement like that. And I think to a certain degree, expecting that we'll be able to put things of true, real meaning into forms like that is a bit of a pipe dream. If more carbon dioxide than higher temperatures, more carbon dioxide than higher temperatures, I mean, we can use that to take a look at some of the incredibly complex issues that we talk about here, the global warming hoax, etc., etc., but it's extremely difficult to break those down into the classical forms of logical argumentation. But even leaving that aside, I mean, think about the scale of detaching true conclusions from true logically valid arguments. We can have a logically valid argument and arrive at a false conclusion because the premises were false. I mean, the premises, the terms that we were using are really extremely important to this process. In order to have total certainty, we'd have to have true premises in a logically valid form to arrive at a certain truth. Well, again, how often does that happen? But even so, to get the premises true is such an incredibly important point. And it serves us well to understand that even if we have a completely logically perfectly constructed, valid, beautiful argument, if we start from false premises, we can arrive at horrific conclusions very easily.
And at the moment, the only philosophically respectable way to defend free will is to adopt a view in academic philosophy that's called compatibilism, and to argue that free will is compatible with the truth of determinism. Now, my friend Dan Dennett is the philosopher is a compatibilist, and he essentially makes the claim that we just have to think about free will differently. If a murderer commits his crime based on his desire to kill and not based on some other thing that's hijacking him, but his actions are actually an expression of his real desires and intentions, well, then that's all the free will you need. But from both a moral and scientific point of view, this seems to miss the point. I mean, where is the freedom in doing what one wants when one's desires are the product of prior events that one is completely unaware of and had no hand in creating? So from my point of view, compatibilism is a little like saying a puppet is free as long as it loves its strings. Now, compatibilists push back here. They say that even if our desires and thoughts and behavior are the product of unconscious causes, that doesn't matter because you are the totality of what goes on inside your brain and body. So your unconscious mental life is just as much you, and your unconscious neurophysiology is just as much you as your conscious inner life is. Okay, but this, to my eye, seems like a bait and switch. Okay, this trades a psychological fact, this experience we have of consciously authoring our thoughts and actions, for a general conception of ourselves as persons. It's a little like saying you are made of stardust, okay, which you are, but you don't feel like stardust. And the knowledge that you're stardust is not driving your moral intuitions and influencing our system of criminal justice. The fact is that most people identified with a certain channel of information in their conscious minds. They feel that they are in control, they are the source, and this is an illusion.
To say that you are responsible for everything that goes on inside your skin, because it's all you, is to make a claim that bears absolutely no relationship to the actual experience that has made free will a problem for philosophy. The truth is, we feel or presume an authorship over our own thoughts and actions that is illusory. If I could detect all of your conscious thoughts and intentions and subsequent behaviors with a brain scanner some moments before you were aware of them, you would be rightly shocked, because it would undermine your sense that you are the prime mover of your inner life. How can we be free as conscious agents if everything we consciously intend was caused by events in our brain which we did not intend and over which we had no control? We can't.
So I always enjoy listening to Sam Harris, and I don't agree with a lot of his positions, but I find him to be a very entertaining and engaging speaker. And I came across a talk that he gave on YouTube recently. It was called The Illusion of Free Will, and I think this relates to a book that he is currently promoting, simply called Free Will. Well, you know, here's a guy who's smarter than I am and, you know, has a background in neuroscience and is offering up a position on a very, very important philosophical issue where I am, you know, almost the polar opposite. Or so I thought, if he's going to say, you know, everything is determined, we definitely do not have free will. It was a challenge that I was up for. I think it's important to seek those challenges out. And I think I came out of it successful. I don't find myself any more enticed than before I spent the hour and 20 minutes listening to Harris talk, because I think that as impressive as his presentation is, and he's talking about these neurological studies that have been conducted and using fMRI machines to do scans on the brain, he makes a pretty crucial mistake. Or I don't know if he does it on purpose. I don't know if he is trying to skip over the jargon of neuroscience to make his book more accessible to more people. I don't know if he's taking this hardline position on the free will determinism debate to be provocative. I don't know much about what his intentions are. But Harris says the idea that we can act independent of our conditioning, of our genetics, our previous environmental exposure or experience, that's a silly idea. I said, oh no, I believe that we can do that. So this is a debate that's obviously gone on for a long time. Honestly, it's something that I've stayed away from because it gives me a headache. You know, there's a lot of more abstruse philosophical and neurological concepts involved. Another reason why it makes my head hurt a little bit is because I also think that people do a very poor job in most of the discussions that I've seen defining their terms. And that's kind of an important thing. And, you know, Sam Harris, he goes and he speaks and he writes for a certain audience, and I think it's assumed that he has a certain authority on this subject. He can also afford to be a little bit lazy, the same way Dawkins could be if he wanted to, like we talked about in the last show, because there are people who really, for lack of a better word, just worship him. He doesn't have to win the crowd over. Those people go there to eat out of his hand. And let me just be super especially clear here, okay? I'm not saying that Dawkins and Sam Harris are involved in some kind of confidence scheme where they win people's trust and then deceive them. What I'm saying is that their expertise and cult of personality appeal might create situations where debates that should be going on are skipped over, or things are taken as things are taken for granted. And what that means to me, why that's important, is that he can say, okay, well, we all agree on this background knowledge that I've gathered and brought here for you because I'm the expert. So now let me work with that knowledge that will not be questioned in these logically coherent relationships and then come to a conclusion on which we all agree. And in the end, you know, everything just seems to make sense. Free will, folks, is an illusion, says Sam Harris. And while we're talking about the defining of terms, to be fair here, fair and balanced, I think there's plenty of proponents of free will who are even more sloppy than Harris is when it comes to, you know, trying to clarify what each side is actually all about. And they build this straw man against the determinism side of the argument by either deliberately or accidentally confusing it with fatalism, which is pretty much what it sounds like, that everything that happens in existence is completely subjugated to fate, right? So you might hear them say, well, why are we even having a debate about this? If determinism is true, you're not going to be able to change my mind. Like, that's a very simplistic argument, but I have heard that. Now, back to Sam Harris's talk. There's all kinds of other factors here that at least need to be taken into consideration when we're evaluating these claims. In this, guys who are primarily famous or have pop culture appeal because they are atheists speaking circuit scene that people like Dawkins and Harris are a part of, well, there's this perception of a war between science and religion. And remember that free will is, for many people, a religious idea. And neuroscience is not a religious idea. So he's kind of pitting science against religion, and we know what side on which he is going to be more entrenched, more dug in. And that's fine, of course. Obviously, we choose science over mysticism. But I don't think free will exists only as a religious idea. And that also doesn't mean that determinism is entirely wrong. In fact, bear with me, folks, okay? Bear with me. I don't think it is always wrong. And I'm not talking about for, like, you know, birds and toads. I'm talking about for people. Bear with me. The other thing that I've always found frustrating about the free will determinism debate is the black or white nature of it that a lot of the debaters on either side seem to suggest. I mean, if you look at the science of behaviorism, if you look at the work of Edward Bernays, the world is set up around the idea that human beings are stimulus response mechanisms, and human beings continue providing evidence that supposition is correct, seemingly so. Human beings are very good at providing evidence that people can be easily manipulated as these input-output machines. My position is, I think free will is something that you have to earn. Okay, so I totally agree with Sam Harris saying, you know, the idea that this is a gift bestowed upon humanity by God is stupid. And I think that we are susceptible. We're very, very susceptible to you know, the impact of our genetics, to conditioning. I would say that there was times in my life, there was courses of actions that I took that were determined, you know, by certainly by emotion, certainly by fear, certainly by programming and conditioning, genetics, unconscious forces, etc. But that doesn't mean that you can't learn your way out of doing that. But what Harris is saying is that, you know, even when you think that you're making a decision, there's all kinds of not just genetic factors, but experiential factors that are even, you know, leading up to you acting on that desire. So you say, oh, I have this desire, and then I decide to act on that, but I have free will. And what Harris is saying is it's not free will that that desire forms, or that the thought process that leads up to the manifestation of that desire, that's not, you don't have ownership over that. What I'm saying is we can have more ownership over it through metacognition, through self-knowledge. I did a show a couple years ago about Osama bin Laden, and I used this quote by this psychologist and Holocaust survivor named Viktor Frankl, who said, there's a space, and I don't remember the exact quote. I'm going to paraphrase it. There is a space between stimulus and response, and in that space lies your freedom. But I think that what Harris does is he's very successful in his book and in this talk that I watch at controlling the box by saying these are the definitions that we're going to work with, and then I'll throw out the logical relationships for your evaluation and review, but there's not going to be a tremendous amount of discussion about how I define free will. For the Sam Harris fan, the really big Sam Harris fan, whatever comes out of Sam Harris's mouth is gold kind of guy or gal, this looks like an ironclad, bulletproof, airtight presentation, the case against free will. But for him, like I said before, it is very much an all or nothing concept. We either have free will or we do not have free will. And what Harris claims in this talk is that in order for free will to be a real thing and not an illusion, that you would need to be aware, this is a quote now, need to be aware of all the factors that determine your thoughts and actions, and you would need to have complete control over those factors. Well, that's setting an absolutely impossible standard. It's that saying free will can't be real because you live in a world and have a subconscious. But then he also says that free will requires that we could not have behaved differently than we did in the past. Otherwise, we would have. But that reminds me of something. If we could have behaved differently, then we would have. And this just kind of brings up my own biases, my own preconceived notions and emotions that I bring to this conversation. Because I see this as more of an evolutionary thing, right? Because there were times where the species that we are completely followed biological cues, unquestioningly. And through the development of philosophy and an understanding of psychology, that has certainly changed. Certainly, it's changed in half a century. And I remember being a younger man, and I can't believe I'm entering these names into an even semi-scientific discussion. Like Timothy Leary, Robert Anton Wilson, these real spacey fruitcake type guys, right? Who did some good work and had some very profound and interesting things to say, but their work was also just filled with a lot of like far out speculation. But they had this dream. And I remember reading Robert Anton Wilson's book, Cosmic Trigger, and being really inspired by the idea that we as human beings could gain, as Timothy Leary thought, eventually, through evolution, a total operational control over the circuitry of the human brain. Even that idea, even if it's silly, it was inspiring to me. And it also alerted me to the progress that humanity has made as a species in using logic and metacognition and self-awareness as tools to fight off what have become kind of silly things that we are prompted to do through our biology.
Impulses or drives that at one time might have been very useful, even essential from a survival standpoint, but today make about as much sense as my coccyx bone does.
Timothy Leary, Robert Anton Wilson, I haven't read their stuff in many, 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 many years. But more recently, I was really pleased to find an article in the New York Times. It was written by a gentleman, a philosopher I'd never heard of before, named Eddie Namias. And the title of the piece was called, Is Neuroscience the Death of Free Will? I really thought that he did a perfect job of breaking down Harris's argument in a way that's useful to us for this show. So basically, the first claim that Harris makes in his definition of free will is that it requires something, as I said before, a total operational awareness and control over thoughts and actions in their entirety. Now, that is impossible.
So free will is impossible. Harris's logic here is impeccable. If A is required for B to exist, and A is impossible, A itself does not exist, then B does not exist. It requires A, A is not real. But that requires that you accept that definition that he laid out. And I don't think it's that simple. I want to share with you just a couple paragraphs from this New York Times article. We should be wary of defining things out of existence. Define Earth as a planet at the center of the universe, and it turns out there is no Earth. Define what's moral as whatever your God mandates, and suddenly most people become immoral. Define marriage as a union only for procreation, and you thereby annul many marriages. The sciences of the mind do give us good reasons to think that our minds are made of matter, but to conclude that consciousness or free will is thereby an illusion is too quick. It's like inferring from discoveries in organic chemistry that life is an illusion just because living organisms are made up of non-living stuff. Much of the progress in science comes precisely from understanding wholes in terms of their parts, without this suggesting the disappearance of the wholes. There's no reason to define the mind or free will in a way that begins by cutting off this possibility for progress. Our brains are the most complexly organized things in the known universe, just the sort of thing that could eventually make sense of why each of us is so unique, why we are conscious creatures, and why humans have abilities to comprehend, converse, and create that go well beyond the precursors of these abilities in other animals. Neuroscientific discoveries over the next century will uncover how consciousness and thinking work the way they do because our complex brains work the way they do. These discoveries about how our brains work can also explain how free will works rather than explaining it away. But first, we need to define free will in a more reasonable and useful way. Many philosophers, including me, understand free will as a set of capacities for imagining future courses of action, deliberating about one's reasons for choosing them, planning one's actions in light of this deliberation, and controlling actions in the face of competing desires. We act of our own free will to the extent that we have the opportunity to exercise these capacities without unreasonable external or internal pressure. We are responsible for our actions roughly to the extent that we possess these capacities and we have opportunities to exercise them. These capacities for conscious deliberation, rational thinking, and self-control are not magical abilities. They need not belong to the immaterial souls outside the realm of scientific understanding. Indeed, since we don't know how souls are supposed to work, souls would not help explain these capacities. Rather, these are the sorts of cognitive capacities that psychologists and neuroscientists are well positioned to study. This conception of free will represents a long-standing and dominant view in philosophy, though it is typically ignored by scientists who conclude that free will is an illusion. It also turns out most non-philosophers have intuitions about free will and responsible action that track this conception of free will. Researchers in the new field of experimental philosophy study what the folk think about philosophical issues and why. For instance, my collaborators and I have found that most people think free will and responsibility are compatible with determinism, the thesis that all events are part of a law-like chain of events, such that earlier events necessitate later events. That is, most people judge that you can have free will and be responsible for your actions even if your decisions and actions are entirely caused by earlier events in accord with natural laws. Our study suggests that people sometimes misunderstand determinism to mean that we are somehow cut out of this causal chain leading to our actions. People are threatened by a possibility I call bypassing, the idea that our actions are caused in ways that bypass our conscious deliberations and decisions. So if people mistakenly take causal determinism to mean that everything that happens is inevitable, no matter what you think or try to do, then they conclude that we have no free will. Or if determinism is presented in a way that suggests that all our decisions are just chemical reactions, then they take it to mean that our conscious thinking is bypassed in such a way that we lack free will. I wanted to include that because I think that Nemias does a much better job of defining, elucidating, and dealing with the nuances of this issue, much better job than Harris does in his presentation, and I'm assuming his book, where he makes the claim. I mean, he does that, you know, free will requires this, and he has several things that go into what that is. So just for example, another one that free will requires something that goes beyond the physical, the material, the chemical of the brain, something supernatural. Another idea that he puts forward as something that is a prerequisite for the existence of free will is that we are the conscious source for all our thoughts and actions, which we know is impossible. But we can engage in a process of deliberation. We can deal with temptation. We can dispute irrational beliefs. And we can develop strategies for, you know, new, more effective and life-affirming and life-enriching beliefs and subsequent courses of action. And to that, Sam Harris says, yeah, Brett, that's a wonderful, heartwarming story of facing a difficult situation and overcoming the odds. But all of the tools that you use to do that also exist in this causal structure, where the thoughts that you use to overcome temptation, et cetera, are all predetermined genetically, environmentally, chemically. So don't trick yourself into thinking that you are the author or the controller of that process. So in other words, let me define for all of you, says Sam Harris, what free will is, and then sit there and listen to me reason it out of existence. And I'm not buying that, okay? Like with magic, it's the one simple thing that you don't see that can make what you do see so convincing. And in this Sam Harris presentation, that little sleight of hand is his definition of terms, right? Because the logic that follows is pretty much flawless. And a lot of people are nervous about the term, the trivium, because it has this religious origin. And I've even talked to some people who attended religious schools. I think Tony Myers, who's been on the show a couple times and was in the introduction to this series, was the first person who brought this up. He said that that crucial first step in knowledge acquisition in the trivium, the grammar or the background knowledge, was kind of skipped over, or it was prepackaged. Actually, let me just pull that clip and have him say it. This is School Sucks podcast number 130, Logic Saves Lives, Introduction, Empowerment, and Self-Defense with Richard Grove and Tony Myers.
So we're trying to get to the heart of what exactly is grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and how can we use this and employ this in our daily lives. So I had some familiarity with it because I went to a parochial school when I was younger. And being in a Catholic environment, they did introduce some elements of logic and especially rhetoric. They really hounded rhetoric, speeches, and all these different sorts of things. We always had to go do something like of that nature.
But they give you prepackaged grammar or knowledge that you're not supposed to question.
Exactly. And they taught induction and deduction, but it was in a very broken form and understanding, and it was hard to apply it to our writing and our own rhetoric.
I want to just jump back to something that you were saying a minute ago. When you were saying that these people have a prepackaged grammar, could you expound on that a little bit and tell us just what you mean by that?
Sure, the idea is that these people are instilled with a preset data set, if you will. And so they're given already the definitions to certain philosophies, certain terms that would be used in sophisticated argumentation. They're given all of this as a prepackaged form. So they're taught to learn it. Well, they're taught to learn it just verbatim, kind of how you would memorize it. Then from there, they take the techniques and they go into kind of the conceptual ideas of the techniques, the way they express some of these ideas that they're already justifying when they're getting from the very young. So oftentimes we find these wealthy men of science or philosophy trying to justify many times the ventures of either their family or, you know, the philosophy of the religion to which they belong. I know God, I believe, mentioned Calvinism, all these different forms of Protestantism which broke off, and you know, King Henry VIII as well. So we look at all these different paths. A lot of these things, they seem to use logic to justify why they're doing certain actions. And it's funny because they continually use it in a way to coerce, where in fact that's contradictory by nature. So I
can also just add a little perspective that might help clarify that, because it's like muddy water that we really need to filter right this moment before we even go on. And I would suggest that it's this, that belief systems they act as counterfeit knowledge. So you're not going based on experience and what exists. You're going on, this person wrote a book and this book is truth, and it's truth because this person wrote this book. It gets into all this circular reasoning, right? And so what it turns out is it's counterfeit knowledge, which is accepted as truth. So it's illusion accepted as truth. And that is unquestioned, and that's the first step, that knowledge step. And then it just goes about organizing and reorganizing this thing that you're assuming is truth when there's, you know, it lacks evidence, right? And so it's whether it's the Jesuits or the Mormons or any number of other secret societies who occult useful information, they then give you this other prepackaged indoctrination. And it's exactly how you use the natural methods of the mind, which are encapsulated in the trivium, to control people instead of liberate them.
So in the last show, I made a comment, pop atheism has kind of become, unfortunately, this religion where Richard Dawkins is the god. Why would I use the word religion? Because it's the same thing that Rich and Tony were just talking about. Now, how does that happen? The reason why is because there's a lot of these worshipful followers who were brought to these people like Harrison Dawkins, because they're atheists and they're willing to outsource a certain amount of research and acquisition of background knowledge to these people because they like them and they trust them and they have these kind of cults of personality appeals to them. And, you know, as far as this whole commentary on the Sam Harris free will versus determinism debate, somebody in that audience accepting Sam Harris's definitions and becoming a determinist, abandoning the idea of free will, well, dare I say, that seems pretty innocuous compared to some examples that come to mind of people trusting experts on issues where perhaps they should have dug a little deeper.
In the run-up to the war in Iraq, the failure of mainstream news organizations to raise legitimate questions about the government's rush to war was compounded by the network's deliberate decision to stress military perspectives before any fighting had even begun.
We've got generals, and if you ask them about the prospects for war with Iraq, they think it is almost certain.
CNN's use of retired generals as supposedly independent experts reinforced a decidedly military mindset, even as serious questions remained about the wisdom and necessity of going to war.
Often journalists blame the government for the failure of the journalists themselves to do independent reporting. But nobody forced the major networks like CNN to do so much commentary from retired generals and admirals and all the rest of it. You had a top CNN official named Eason Jordan going on the air of his network and boasting that he had visited the Pentagon with a list of possible military commentators. And he asked officials at the Defense Department whether that was a good list of people to hire.
Well, I think it's important to have experts explain the war and to describe the military hardware, describe the tactics, talk about the strategy behind the conflict. I went to the Pentagon myself several times before the war started, met with important people there, and said, for instance, at CNN, here are the generals we're thinking of retaining to advise us on the air and off about the war, and we got a big thumbs up on all of them. That was important.
It wasn't even something to hide, ultimately. It was something to say to the American people on his own network, see, we're team players. We may be the news media, but we're on the same side and the same page as the Pentagon. And that really runs directly counter to the idea of an independent press. And that suggests that we have some deep patterns of media avoidance when the U.S. is involved in a war based on lies.
So it's a little bit like creating a report asking whether the banks were to blame for the 2008 financial meltdown and only talking to people from Goldman Sachs. I mean, we know which way that that type of report is going to go. And so there has to be some skepticality of these types of reports. And I don't think we necessarily need to remind people just how important it is to be skeptical of all media reports in these times, especially when there seems to be a push towards rallying the public around a military intervention. But again, it has happened time and time and time and time again in recent history, even let alone longer periods of history. And we see it, unfortunately, perhaps coming to fruition again here in Syria. Unfortunately, we live in an age where media manipulation is so easy that it starts to become more and more difficult to tell reality from fiction, especially when so much of the Western media is controlled by so few corporations. It does certainly raise at least the specter of that type of whole-scale manipulation. But of course, manipulation can be also much more subtle than that, and there are many different ways in which the media can steer a conversation towards the direction that the establishment wishes, from suppressing information that goes against the grain to amplifying information that seems to suggest whatever the establishment is looking for, to framing the conversation in a certain way. If we can frame the conversation to talk about whether or not we need military intervention to stop the Assad government, that takes away from the real conversation that should be going on.
I have been, you know, working on this series for, I think at this point, like 6 or 7 months, slowly chipping away kind of a survey course in logic and really specifically logical fallacies. And the title of the series is Logic Saves Lives. So when I saw the title, Logic Is Not Enough, I was interested to hear what you meant. And of course, we know that logic alone is not sufficient for always coming to correct conclusions. Maybe, first of all, maybe it would be better if you could just give us an abstract, like a rundown on what the purpose of that show was.
Right. Well, as the title would indicate, basically the premise, the underlying premise is that logic would be a necessary but not sufficient condition for arriving at truth certainty. But I think the more the secondary sort of conclusion that I tried to draw out was that not only is logic necessary but not sufficient for coming to truth certainty, but that truth certainty as a goal in and of itself is not only something that I think is ultimately unattainable, but something that I don't think should be strived towards as an ideal, because it tends toward an ideology, a mindset that I think is amenable to the types of swaying by people with social control as their main idea. And I think they do this through a type of scientism that has been bred into the population. Now, this gets into a lot of different areas, but I think something that I was trying to draw out to a certain extent is that that a lot of what we are interested in are valuations that are not themselves empirically reducible. And I would point people in the direction of someone like Martin Heidegger and his work, The Question Concerning Technology, talking about the attempt by modern science to reduce everything to empirically derivable results, which themselves reduce the world to what he called standing reserve. And I think a part of that is this this notion that that drives the scientific dictatorship crowd and the people like the Wellses and the Huxleys and others who had that idea, which is to try to reduce everything to empirically derivable and logically reproducible arguments that will lead inevitably to a certain conclusion, which almost always, when it's presented in that context, is going to be, well, we need social control of this form to produce this type of individual. And it can be quite compelling when that idea is put into a logical argumentation form. So that was kind of the gamut of ideas I was trying to cram into that episode, but I may or may not have failed in attempting to put that all in.
No, I found the show to be an important reminder. And there's a 3-word quote by Ayn Rand that's been uttered on my show probably well over 100 times. Check your premises. And you were saying that somebody could be perfectly syllogistically sound and still arrive at a faulty conclusion. Right. So this is where you know, background knowledge is very important. And it raised this question also in the episode, are people logical? And it seemed to be that the conclusion was leaning towards no. Based on a lot of the experience that I've had in debate with people, I would often say, gosh, yeah, people are just not, they're just not logical. But I think that's a little bit dismissive on my part. I think that people, whether they're logical or not, they certainly have a sensitivity to and an awareness of it. Like, in other words, I've never been having a debate with somebody where they say, oh, Brett, you know, here's something you should know about me. I just say things that make me feel good. And I really don't care whether they're true or not. It's just kind of my thing. No one ever says that. Everyone always acts as if they have a reason to believe what they believe. The problem that I observed in other people and myself for a long time was one of empiricism, where, you know, for the most part, most of the people I deal with, the inputs, the senses, they work just fine. You know, it's something happens. There's almost like a buffer, like a program that's been installed into the brain that disrupts a clear assessment of what the inputs are giving them. Like, they see a man in a costume hitting an unarmed person with a stick, you know, but then there's this program that says, I wonder what the unarmed person who's getting hit with the stick did wrong, you know, because we have this context that we see all this stuff in. But at the same time, these people would always want to offer reasons for what they believe and why. It's just, you know, the premises need to be checked. I was having a debate with somebody about gun control recently. And, you know, I was talking about the genocides that had happened in a lot of countries out in your neck of the woods after gun bans, Cambodia, for one, China. And the person said, I never heard anything like that. And I paused for a minute. And, you know, I wanted to be sensitive and sympathetic and try to understand what it would be like to try and process what is going on in the mainstream media right now in terms of this whole gun discussion without any knowledge, any background knowledge that governments have used, you know, disarming the public as a precursor to slaughtering them, you know, and to not understand that concept, to be missing that piece of background knowledge or to try and interact with somebody who's missing that piece of background knowledge, you're not really having a debate. Even though they might take whatever information that they've gathered from wherever they've gathered it and be able to organize it properly and produce clear, logical relationships with that information, all their premises are wrong. So I think it's important to recognize, and in the last Logic Saves Live show we did actually dealt a lot with the emotions, that this is more complicated than, you know, having sound arguments yourself and pointing out the fallacies that other people are using to really have clear communication and for people to arrive productively and efficiently at mutual understanding. So I found the show to be very useful.
Yes, well, I don't disagree with anything that you're saying there. And perhaps I'm one step ahead of the game because I'm kind of arguing. I'm not arguing against the use of logical argumentation. I'm trying to argue against the reliance on a mindset, as I say, that feeds into an ideology whereby what we are striving for is the type of truth certainty where everything will be 100% deducible. And what I'm trying to posit here is something against, for example, the ideology that's driving, for example, the proponents of the Zeitgeist Venus Project type ideas, where what I see as the fundamental problem with that is something that was, again, articulated, I think, quite well by Adam Curtis in Pandora's Box, where he went over the history of Magnitogorsk in the Soviet Union as this type of community that they were trying to bring in that was going to be the manufacturing center and the proud beacon of industrial manufacturing for the Soviet Union. And it went over in great detail how the central planning of the Soviets ended up failing so signally. And that's because it got to this ridiculous point where they were getting literally reams and reams and reams and reams and reams of data from all parts of the Soviet Union, the central planners were getting this information, and then they were having to make decisions like, for example, what color toothbrush should we produce and how many of them will we need? What kind of stockings will women want, and what's the best way to produce that, et cetera, et cetera. So you have these central planners that are trying to use this data to try to process this information, where, I mean, the ridiculousness of it really hits you when you start to see that, for example, they're literally trying to use this data to try to determine what color toothbrush to give people. And this, to me, is the ridiculousness of this idea that we're all going to live in plastic cities with, you know, computers that are going to use some algorithm, which has never been produced, but we're assured exists, which has solved the calculation problem that's been put forward by Mises and others, that it's going to be able to tell us exactly what we are going to want and the exact best way to produce that. And I am very, very, very skeptical of that, because I think it does come down to things which are not subject to ultimately rational discourse. I mean, what color toothbrush you want is not something that is ever going to have any sort of rational basis. And you could argue that it's such a trivial thing that it doesn't matter. So just make it whatever the natural color of the plastic is and just give everyone the same color kind of thing. But I think fundamentally that goes against sort of human nature. I don't like to employ that term, but I think that at a certain base level, we need that room for individual whims to be included, at least to have a space for that in any system. So I'm just against this idea of some sort of scientific dictatorship where sort of robots and computers and algorithms are going to tell us how to run our lives. And I'm not seeing that as an imminent possibility. I'm just saying that that's where I see things going down the road. So again, in terms of arguing with people, I am all for using and employing logically valid arguments. But I don't want to hold that up as the ideal that we're striving towards some sort of truth certainty that's going to tell us that exactly how to sort of live our lives and everything down to the nth detail. I think it's that type of micromanagement which is part of the scientific dictatorship mentality, which is something that I've been sort of contemplating and worrying about for a long time, because I think that that is the ultimate end result of things like the Brave New World type of world that has been being constructed for at the very least a century through the diligent work of the various social controls and behaviorists and others who want to basically puppeteer society.
Yes, this technical dictatorship, it sounds like a guaranteed nightmare scenario playing out. Like all the things that failed with humans and communism, let's just try them again with robots. And I know maybe that's not what Peter Joseph is pushing exactly or even close, but there is this problem with these predictive models for the management of society. And this was one of the great problems with communism, like you mentioned, is that they always failed to take into account human action and human emotion, because you can't. You can't put those into systems. And this is why we see all of these societies that started out with such beautiful dreams of the future in China and in Russia deteriorate so quickly into these violent totalitarian hellholes, because I think the people at the top, and you know, whether we're talking about the top of the government or the most influential people in pushing the ideology or in seeing that the ideology survives, they're like, this is a beautiful plan and it's going to work. You know, humans be damned. And the humans were damned in that scenario. Because they had to conform or be forced to conform to fit into these rigid models. And of course, we see that today after over 100 years of government school in the United States, where, yeah, there is a lot of planning. There is a lot of a bean counting. And whenever you have those any top-down system of control like that, people got to act right. You know, as far as the controllers are concerned, and you know, how have they dealt with it in schooling in America? Well, drugs are coming into it. This is one of the things that's mentioned in a lot of these dystopian, you know, I hate to laugh because it's not funny, but these dystopian science fiction future books where the people are drugged, the zero tolerance, the totalitarian state that comes alive in the schools. These all start out with well thought out plans that if you know, check the person's logic alone, they seem to be they seem to be on the right track. But what always seems to be absent is the consideration for human action and human emotion.
That's right. And it goes back to what we were saying earlier in this conversation, where we're talking about the neocons and others. And there are people who genuinely do believe in these ideologies. And I think that that in and of itself is something that's important to remember, and something that's in some ways scariest to consider, because people are so often led into the most horrific atrocities because they genuinely do believe that they're striving for a better world. And people who are genuinely motivated by that belief that they have, that they are on the right track, and so anyone who is opposed to them must be eliminated, I think that leads to the most horrific despotism that we've seen throughout history.
Oh, yeah. I've never admitted this on the show before, but I remember being a young liberal and, right out of college, maybe still in college. And I actually said this out loud one day. I said, I wish people could just be made to think how I do. I didn't know there was whole teams of work on that in academia and government and the media. It was just kind of a fleeting thought. I think I might have said something like that to my father, who always fancied himself more of a conservative and eventually a libertarian. And he was like, Jesus, Brett. You know, it was something that got that response. But
well, at least you were able to consciously articulate that. I think a lot of people do believe that. They just don't actually, they would never admit that to themselves.
Yeah. No, I think it was just the feeling of being so young and naive to a certain extent and having such an exposure to all of this new information. I wrote down a couple quotes from the episode. I wanted to ask you about this one. You can't be rational without being emotional. We always think about that as maybe it's a misconception, but that's like a dichotomy. It's either or. What does that mean? You can't be rational without being emotional.
Well, I think that, again, this is part of understanding the totality of humanity rather than just trying to partition it out. And I think that there are emotional considerations in the psyche of human beings that cannot and should not be discounted. I don't remember that precise quote, actually, so I don't know the context in which it came. But that would be my first approximation at an answer.
I think it was in one of the clips that you played.
Right. Yes, actually, there was a clip that I played, and part of what I was trying to demonstrate there is also I think we can't dismiss the psychological understanding of humanity that we've gained in the past century and a half or so. I'm not certainly not to say that Freud was right about everything or something like that, but I think that an understanding of the subconscious drives is absolutely essential to understanding humanity, because we keep getting this experimentally confirmed, et cetera, in studies. I mean, I'm sure people have heard about some of the recent studies that have come out that show that people are more likely to believe information that corresponds to their underlying ideology and discount information that doesn't. I mean, there's actually been studies on this recently, so that there's kind of it's baked into the cake that people are more likely to sort of side with or to even process information that conforms with their view of reality. But this shouldn't be surprising to us. I mean, I think we should understand that we are motivated by subconscious drives and instincts that we only dimly, if ever, comprehend, and that a lot of our reasoning is post facto, that we come up with rationalizations for things after the fact. And I think we have to understand that there is that sort of emotional and instinctual underpinning to so much of what we do, and to understand humanity without understanding that, I think, is the height of folly.
I've said on my show before that metacognition or thinking about our thinking is something that's relatively new. But, you know, I've also kind of, for most people, I think that thinking, like real deep thought about our feelings and even that might be relatively new. I mean, if you look at the way most people lived 100 years ago, 150 years ago, working on a farm, 18-hour days, certainly it wasn't everybody. Certainly there's always been a leisure class that has had time for these kinds of things. But this, these huge pockets of free time that we enjoy today have allowed, you know, more and more of us to go into our own minds and start to understand these things in a way a majority of people might have lived their whole lives without ever even contemplating. I think it's interesting.
I agree completely. I think that our environmental situation produces or fails to produce the type of room for reflection on that. And I could see it, the development of human society as kind of the development of human consciousness at the same time. And I think there is a kind of combination and an interplay of the economic conditions that create the space for this type of discussion. I mean, it's interesting to me to think of if I had been born 100 years ago, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be doing this and I certainly wouldn't be living in Japan. I mean, my family roots go back to Newcastle in Northern England. So I would probably be down in a coal mine working 16 hours a day. And it's bizarre to me to think of that because it's so far detached from who I think I am, at least in this present age, and what I've been able to express and articulate and the person I've developed into. And it's interesting to think of ourselves as the product of our environment. And it's not something we often get the chance to do because we want to protect our identity. We think that there's something core about who we are in this particular circumstance that is us. Mm. But just a slightly different timing of your birth and you'd be a completely different human being. And I think it's important for us to reflect on that and to understand and process human history in terms of the economic conditions and the technological conditions, et cetera, that were holding sway during that time frame as well.
And it's really wonderful that we were born at a time, since we're not, you know, part of the aristocrat class and or well-born, or that we had logic, you know, through the technology that we have, we had logic available as a tool to us. I think people always, they do naturally develop some logical processes, but the things that we've been able to learn and communicate to other people are, it's information, it's tools we would not have had access to had we been born 100 years ago. Certainly there's people who've always understood this. There's people, you know, any time in history who have used an understanding of this against people like us 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 1,000 years ago. So the fact that we have in our hands this tool that allows us to get emotional needs met, because I think that's what it's really about. And one of the ideas that was communicated in that episode is that sometimes you don't even see this process going on, right? It's happening kind of behind the scenes, in the background, but it is happening. Logic is very much a strategy, I think, for getting personal needs met, where sometimes it might be easier or even more personally advantageous to not behave in a reasonable, rational manner. But there is like an emotional need for belonging and acceptance that, kind of encourages us to act logically.
Well, that's an extremely good way to put it. In fact, perhaps that hits the nail on the head a little more squarely than what I've articulated, because I think ultimately logic is a tool, and it's a very useful tool and an extremely important one for us to understand how to wield, and to understand that it can be wielded for values that are contrary to the ones that we have. So I think it's important to understand that it is a tool that can be wielded for great things and also for destructive ends as well, if that's the purpose. So I think, again, it comes down to core values that are motivating the use of that tool.
Yeah. Now, when we talk about that just for a minute, logic being used against people, what does that mean to you? What do you think are some examples of that?
Well, again, I would point towards people like Bertrand Russell and others who had, I think, very logical arguments for why we do need a sure. world government, and we need to subsume our individual sovereignty to that in order to protect world peace. And again, if it's the argument is framed in a certain way and the premises are presented as fait accompli, then looking at the birth of the nuclear era, well, then obviously, how else are we going to protect ourselves against these nuclear powers that have these nuclear weapons? We need an authority that's above these individual nation states in order to control the type of nuclear war that we can see coming to shape. So one could understand how someone like Bertrand Russell could have even perhaps been motivated by genuine desire for promoting an ideology that he thought would actually save billions of lives. But at the same time, it's an ideology that just happens to correspond to exactly what has been written about has been quested after for totalitarians since basically the dawn of human civilization, which is total control in a centralized authority over the entire globe. And that's actually something that is sort of coming into view at this point. It's something that's even feasible to contemplate, the idea of global governance becoming global government, and perhaps being done so for reasons that themselves sound laudable, and through arguments that, if one accepts the premises, can follow logically through valid argumentation towards the inevitable end of global government. So I think that that's one example of how that can be wielded. And again, as you say, it's back to check your premises. And if the premises are that we need some centralized authority in order to protect us from, you know, the tyranny of individual nation states wreaking nuclear war, then I think, I mean, if we have to accept the existence of nation states and then accept the existence of global government, then it can be a logical argumentation, but it stems from false premises.
You do a lot of media analysis on your show also. By the way, it's refreshing to see you once in a while on RT. But, you know, as far as media analysis is concerned, this is all wildly popular today, where the basic function of the mainstream media or the basic setup for most of their presentations is that they will present to us, the audience, experts. What these experts bring to the table as far as a grammar, as far as a background knowledge, as far as definitions, it cannot be questioned. Who are you? You're the guy watching TV. You know, how could you question my definitions, my background knowledge? They will then, you know, put all the work with all that stuff in logical relationships that make sense to us that don't usually, I mean, obviously, depending on what the presentation is, there could be you know, an episode of Real Time with Bill Maher or an episode of the O'Reilly Factor, you could identify 60 or 70 fallacies, but they do still have some adherence that most people will accept to logic. It's the background knowledge is really where you get us. And this presentation of these people on television as experts is something that really goes unquestioned. And unfortunately, it's very, very difficult to do that because, you know, first of all, our schooling has given us this idea that we don't know as much as the person who's at the front of the room, who, when we are adults, becomes the person on the other side of the television screen. And we don't have a lot of confidence in our ability to question those things. So one of the reasons why I pursued the logic series was at least give yourself, yeah, you're not going to be an expert on the Cyprus banking situation. You're not going to be an expert on the Middle East. You're not going to be an expert on Goldman Sachs for most people. That's just not going to be the situation. So at least install an alarm system that will go off periodically when people are really, really trying to pull one over on you. Like the fallacies were a way to see how much BS people try to throw at you. And even though when we're working, you know, through the trivium, we don't start with logic, but it is maybe a way to understand when somebody is trying to deceive you without having expertise on whatever the subject is that they're presenting.
Well, agreed. Again, it is important to understand those types of fallacies and how they are employed and what it means when someone is presenting a fallacious argument, basically that their argument doesn't support what they're trying to say. So that is important. But again, it can be a logically valid argument that's presented. Again, sure. If it has false premises, then it can lead to the false conclusion and it might sound very convincing. So again, logic is not enough in that sense, not necessary, but not sufficient. But it does go back to the point of media analysis. And on that note, I recently had an episode of my podcast on the myth of objective journalism, which is, I mean, it's interesting, again, to look at the idea of objectivity in journalism and where this idea sprang from. And the fact that it's really a more or less a 20th century invention that stems back to people like Walter Lippmann, who was, along with Edward Bernays, another key person in the development of public relations and our modern era of thinking on society and how it should be structured. And when you start to interrogate that notion, it completely falls apart. I mean, the media, of course, wants to present itself as giving to you objective truth, and it will present both sides of the argument and you can decide, kind of thing. But of course, what information they cover and who they turn to cover it, and even the language in which they present each and every story is in of itself a decision that is made from a certain ideological standpoint. And there's no way to eliminate that. There's no way to say that we can eliminate that, because again, it stems right down to even what type of language you use. If you're calling someone a terrorist or a freedom fighter, I mean, you have to call them something, and both are going to be ideologically loaded terms that come from a certain paradigm and certain perspective. So I think we have to understand that that the media has been specifically constructed, and I think consciously constructed, to present information in the exact type of way that corresponds to the Prussian education system that we've all been indoctrinated in, which, as you say, is that centralized authority presenting you with information as it is, as truth, that we simply have to accept, rather than trying to present a process, present actually the process of coming to an understanding of information, which is much more valuable. I mean, even if you are coming from an ideological perspective that is completely contrary to mine, as long as I understand the perspective you're coming from and you allow me to see your reasoning process, then I can examine the sort of reasoning for its own merits, rather than trying to just take what you're saying and your conclusions and trying to argue against them. I think we have to put our cards on the table, ideologically speaking. And to a certain extent, that's what the internet and internet alternative media, at least the potential, is, that we are once again, each and every one of us, becoming at the very least editors of our own information, and to a large extent, kind of reporters in our own world as well. And and this is an important shift that's taking place right now as we see the decentralization of knowledge, which, I mean, is such an important point in this process. But again, if we don't have that underlying understanding of how logical argumentation and how reasoning can work and should function, then we will be lost in this mess, because again, we will try to turn to experts to try to tell us what the facts are and simply turn our minds off.
The New York Times has revealed that the Pentagon used well-known military analysts like these as a quote-unquote media Trojan horse to spread pro-war propaganda to Americans.
You met with Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld.
Special briefing on Thursday. Very interesting. A lot of good information, especially about post-Saddam, post-regime time. What are we going to do then? It's a very well laid out plan.
As the administration's plan, or lack thereof, unraveled, another group of former generals began calling for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation. His response was to gather his own team of trusted analysts to the Pentagon, where they directly collaborated on talking points and strategy to revive public support for the war. According to transcripts obtained by the Times, many of those talking points later appeared almost verbatim on America's major newscasts.
And this is just coming into CNN right now. The Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has just wrapped up his meeting with retired U.S. generals. Our own military analyst, retired U.S. Air Force Major General Don Shepard, is fresh out of that meeting. He's joining us now live from the Pentagon.
You ought to say, imagine an Iraq ruled by Zarqawi, one talking point suggested, with oil, money, sovereignty, access to the geographical center of the Middle East, blah, blah, blah.
The message needs to be, imagine an Iraq. Imagine Iraq under the control of Zarqawi, with another conveyor belt for tourists combined with oil and water and land and resources. Imagine the effect of that. That's the message that has to get out to the American people.
Focus on the global war on terror, another talking point outline, and link Iraq to Iran.
How deep is this Iran connection?
Well, it's very deep, and Iran continues to get a free pass.
I believe that Iran is now the number one troublemaker in Iraq.
Depict Iraq as a milepost in a continuum in a long war, another analyst suggested. Quote, if you paint it that way, then people won't look for terminal events.
Are we making inroads in the war on terror?
Well, we are, Kimberly. A slow and steady progress. You know, this is a 50-year war. There's not going to be any short-term solution to this, and it's a war that's going to cross a lot of boundaries from Latin America to Africa to Asia, and we're going to be engaged for a very, very long time.
You go on O'Reilly, one of the analysts noted, and he's, quote, eating out of your hand because you're smart.
We appreciate you plugged in, and I want everybody to know. The general knows what he's talking about.
The program involved over 150 analysts in every major news network. On this episode of Chris Matthews' Hardball, for example,
General Wayne Downing, General Montgomery Meigs, and Colonel Ken Howard.
All three military analysts were part of the Pentagon program. This analyst, Kenneth Allard, says he saw a growing gap between what the Pentagon was telling them and reality. Quote, "I felt we'd been hosed," he told the Times, calling the program, quote, "psyops on steroids." Many of the news networks involved said they were unaware of the practice.
Feeding biased information about the war in Iraq to the media through these military analysts that people like myself have been interviewing on TV, who were supposed to be given an objective assessment to the public of what was really going on overseas. Now, the New York Times says most of the TV and the radio military analysts have ties to military contractors, people who could possibly be making money on the war.
Have you had success? You know, we're talking about trying to put this all together as far as a process, not of just understanding, but of communication as well. Have you had success in your own life, meaning outside of the show, communicating these ideas? And it can be whatever topic, you know, you're following, whatever you're particularly passionate about, communicating effectively to other people face to face.
I would say both yes and no. And sometimes at the same time, because one thing that I've found is that almost invariably when I'm talking to people one on one, no matter how strongly they might be coming from a completely different worldview, a different perspective, we can often find the base things that we agree upon, the base the values or goals or whatever it may be that we hold in common. But of course, we have completely different ways of looking at that problem and how to solve it. And that can be an interesting contradiction, because there are times at which I've been talking to people that we agree on a certain perspective, or we agree on a certain historical event or something. They might agree that the official narrative of 9/11 is full of holes and can't possibly be the case, etc. Whatever the case may be. But when we actually start to examine the ideological assumptions underlying all of that and what that means politically, etc., we completely diverge. So I've had more or less success in talking to people, but I've never really seen it as my goal to proselytize about what I'm talking about, so much as simply to open up the conversation and open up the dialogue. And if my role was nothing other than to put these ideas out there in a form, in a presentation that shows a type of reasoning process behind them that can be scrutinized and understood by other people, if that alone was all I was accomplishing, I think that would be in and of itself be valuable. Because again, I do want to break down those types of assumptions that we work on, that there are people from on high who are simply presenting us with facts and information as fait accompli that we can't ever question. And I think simply the process of showing people the questioning and the working against that that received wisdom is in and of itself valuable. So it's incredibly difficult to gauge the success that you have on an individual level with individual people, because I have probably I can't remember very many conversations that I've ever participated in where someone has changed their worldview simply because someone laid out an argument that was persuasive.
Sure.
And one wouldn't expect that to happen. People have paradigms and worldviews and ideologies that are strongly held to and generally only fall away piece by piece after a long time of quiet contemplation, or at least that's my understanding of it. But I think we can be more or less effective in at least communicating our differences with other people. And in that regard, I think I have had some very interesting conversations with people where we do disagree, but we find those points of agreement. And that, in some ways, can be the most sort of exciting kinds of conversations that you can have with people.
Absolutely. You know, I haven't been at the podcasting thing quite as long as you, but I remember in the beginning for me, I was really, I used to spend so much time editing because I was so apprehensive about saying the wrong thing. And, you know, I had a real quality audience right from the beginning, because I got a lot of people from Stefan Molyneux's Free Domain Radio, and I got a lot of people from Wes Bertrand's Complete Liberty who were on board almost right from the beginning. So I knew there was a lot of smart people listening and watching, and that was part of it. But I was really, I felt like I was afraid to tread into new territory a lot of the time. So that struck me when you said, you know, you see yourself as a facilitator of a conversation. Did you feel that pressure initially when you were more maybe influenced by these other media creators and you were first cutting your teeth? like, oh, if I'm going to turn on the mic and talk into it and put it on the internet, I got to be right.
I certainly did have that apprehension at first as well. I think everyone does when they start out with this. And I think that that's something that's very, very difficult for someone who doesn't produce media to appreciate, because there is that tendency that people have that they want to only put out something that's perfect and that will perfectly convey all of their ideas in just the way that they want it conveyed to other people. Of course, that is a pipe dream. And perhaps my perspective as an English literature major back in the day, if that was useful for anything, I think it was at least useful for getting me to interrogate that notion that you'll ever be able to 100% perfectly convey an idea through language, which itself is this amorphous sand, which, you know, I mean, it's received differently than it's sent out. And there are so many trillions and trillions of different little variables that can play into even the simplest of sentences, let alone big chunks of discourse. So I've always been a bit wary of that idea that I'd ever be able to put forward an idea completely 100% into the minds of the listeners through any piece of media I produce. But certainly, I think over the years, you start to realize that there's only so much that you can do. And it's better to produce something and to be honest about where you're coming from and what's informing your perspective, and just putting those cards on the table in order to try to facilitate that conversation.
Okay, everyone, welcome to the continuation of our bonus content previews. All of this stuff that you've been hearing little clips of at the end of the shows is available at schoolsucksproject.com, and you can get access to it by going to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and joining the AV Club, which supports the show. A lot of video stuff, and I realize that not everyone sits in front of their computers and watches videos all day, so I took a lot of our after shows, where we have some very interesting conversations, and converted them to MP3s that you can download and take with you, like you probably do with the podcast. So I haven't done that with all of them yet, but I've done that with a lot of them. This is an example of that.
From June 6, 2012, MP3. And it's me, Corian Osborne. And we're talking philosophy. We're talking here about Friedrich Nietzsche. And we are trying to offer the audience a slightly different perspective on this man. Some things that are often overlooked. This is not a serious clip. Here you go.
We'll open it up for one or two more since we're kind of on a roll. We're just going to stop talking for a minute so I can do a screenshot here of Nietzsche's. This is another German philosopher, Friedrich Nietzsche. I want you to just contemplate for a second or two what might be in this mustache if you comb through it. And we're back. That was Friedrich Nietzsche's mustache. What do you think's in there?
I don't know.
Now, these are the things that I think could be in Nietzsche's mustache that could conceivably fit in that mustache undetected. A chicken leg.
A Volkswagen?
I was going to go for...
Certainly a matchbox car.
I was going to go for a quarter chicken white meat from Boston Market. All up in that mustache.
Quarter chicken?
A quarter chicken. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I would say two strips of bacon could be in there.
Yes.
Now, what other kinds of non-meat things? These are all meat. Maybe a popsicle?
A popsicle stick.
I would say a whole popsicle.
Yeah, but the popsicle would melt.
Melt so fast.
So a popsicle
in that beard,
stick and then like, a lot of sticky
mustache
hairs.
Think about how much insulation is involved with that mustache.
Mm.
That's
okay.
Crazy.
So
I bet that guy could go out skiing for just days at a time without ever getting cold.
With his upper lip will never get cold.
Yeah.
Now, because Mandrick's not here, we have to point out that by skiing, you don't mean sitting on a couch between two guys and giving them both jobs, right? Like that kind of skiing.
Yeah.
You mean
like going up on a mountain.
He cold weather.
Cocaine. Sliding down on your feet.
Cold weather. He couldn't do cocaine. Think about what his cocaine budget would have to be because of what is lost in the mustache.
Oh.
But think of what you could reclaim the next day.
Oh, no, wait. You use a straw. I didn't even think about that.
Generally.
If he could just use a long enough straw that he could bypass the mustache
entirely.
Or he
could just, like, you know, coat the mustache in it and then do like one of these numbers. every once in a while.
You know, for the gums. Rub it on the gums.
Mm. Show me yours again, Osborne. I didn't have the camera on you. Okay, yep, that works.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Did you have one, Corey?
And then he can, well, I was, you know, there was that one where you snort it right out of your own mustache. But there's also, there's also the old, you know, grab some with your tongue to rub on your gums, because.
Do you think he would often offer women mustache rides? And like, you think they took
when you
him
say
up
women?
On that?
I think he would accidentally sweep. He would sweep up women accidentally with his mustache.
When you say women, do you mean like one at a time, but several over a period of time, or like a woman's softball team all at once?
Yes.
Let's have another look at that mustache real quick. We're just going to be quiet here for a second. And mustache. And we're back. That was Friedrich Nietzsche's mustache. Poor guy. You know, I feel bad for him. Hitler's favorite philosopher. That's how he'll be remembered. But very much a perversion of his ideas.
Would it ever bum you out if some evil bastard started listening to your show and made it his favorite? Like, what if it came out that George Bush sits and listens to School Sucks podcast every night?
But how is he, if he just listens to it, that wouldn't bother me, but if he acted on it. Like, what would really piss me off is if...
Or if he like, told people, like, everything I do is based on Brett's School Sucks podcast.
What would really, that would just be crazy. It wouldn't make any sense, but unless he was, but if he was saying, what you have to understand... Is that not,
yeah, that's basically it.
All right. About School Sucks, or anybody, I'm not going to do George Bush, but anybody, what you have to understand about School Sucks podcast is his subtext, right? The hidden messages, right? What he's really saying is that we should do this and that this is right. And if somebody used, you know, to like pretended to decode it to use to their own agenda and start like some kind of cult, I would, that would bother me very much. So,
yeah, that would suck.